Hello, and welcome to our latest Integrated Care System podcast. My name's Cathy McLean, and I'm here today with a panel of senior leaders from across Nottingham and Nottinghamshire Health and Care System to talk about the importance of lifting our gaze from our everyday pressures and priorities and working together more strategically. I'm going to hand over to the panel to introduce themselves, and starting with Anthony May.
Good afternoon, Cathy. I'm Anthony May. I'm the Chief Executive of the Nottingham University Hospitals Trust.
Thank you. Melanie.
Good afternoon, Cathy. So I'm Mel Williams, Executive Director for Adult Social Care at Notts County Council.
Thank you. And Lucy.
Hi, I'm Lucy Hopper. I'm the Director of Public Health for Nottingham.
And to complete the panel, Stephen.
Hi, my credentials are that I've been a tiny, tiny part of the Nottingham Health and Care System since 1981, but I am always first and foremost a GP.
Thank you, Stephen. But before we get on to a conversation that we'll have with the panel, I just wanted to kind of set the scene, really, and give a bit of background context to why we're having this discussion, why we think it's important. We all know, I'm sure, that health and care services are currently under enormous pressure. Demands are constantly rising. We can see those pressures in all sorts of ways, including on our budgets and having sufficient resource to be able to do everything we want to do. But also, it means that it's a great chance to try and transform how we deliver our services so that we can become more sustainable. Our integrated care strategy, which we created last year, will help us and guide us through this work. But we will need to think about how we carve out time beyond the daily challenges so that we can give people the chance to make those changes and also to improve people's health physically and mentally. And we believe that working together with all of our partners at local neighbourhoods, across the wider system and at place, we have the opportunity to be bold and make transformative changes that will not only improve patient outcomes, but also bolster the resilience and sustainability of our health and care system. So with that as a background, I'm going to start by asking Anthony a question. As I said, we signed off our integrated care strategy last year. It's our sort of guide for the whole of the system about some of the big things we want to do. And I just wondered, given you work at our largest hospital or hospitals in the system, I wondered if you could say something about the work you've been doing within the hospital, which kind of move us towards those aims and some of the principles within the strategy.
Yeah, thank you, Cathy. So what I try and remind myself every day at NUH is that we exist in a context, and mostly that context is around the place of Nottingham and Nottinghamshire and the population that we serve. And I then try and look at what's going on in the hospitals and the services that we provide that might give us some idea about how we can exist better in that place and contribute to the wider aims of the integrated care strategy. And there's a number of ways that we do that. But before I set those out, it's probably worth thinking about the way things are in large acute hospitals at the moment. So we had days back in the winter when we were well over 90%, sometimes 97, 98% occupied. And if you take into account that the buffer is for really urgent and emergency incidents, then we're pretty much full. So if we're pretty much full and we know that what we want is to help people avoid coming into hospital, and when they get here, to be here for as short a period as possible and get them out to a place where they can be cared for safely and help them get back to normal life, then it's absolutely imperative that we work with other system partners, because the answer, certainly to preventing people from coming here and getting them out quickly, does not lie entirely within the four walls of the hospitals. We've got a strategy which we call People First, which is the guiding strategy for the Trust. It's our roadmap. Much of that is based on working with our partners. in the context of people first, we've got a population health framework, we've got a social value framework. All of those things are about ensuring that whilst we exist in the place of Nottingham and Nottinghamshire, we play a part in the integration of services, whether it's the work we do on prehabilitation, the work we do with our partners on children that weren't brought to paediatric appointments, whether it's the work we do with Lucy and her colleagues in public health. We've got seven public health master's students that are linked in through Nottingham Trent University. All of those things really matter to us, because if we want to prevent people coming here, get them through the hospital as quickly as possible and discharge them to places where they can recover and get back to their normal lives, we absolutely must work in the context of the integrated care strategy. And of course, alongside that, there's a value for money element in doing those things well. And because we are such a large institution, we employ nearly 20,000 people, we can contribute to broader social and economic development, not only by providing good services and making sure people don't stay in hospital or are outpatients for longer than they need to be, but also because we can provide employment and skills and opportunities. So the integrated care strategy is front and centre of everything we're trying to do here.
So that's really interesting, Anthony, and thank you for setting out there how you're engaging in that. So just to build on that, so our integrated care strategy has prevention, integration and equity at its heart in terms of its principles. You've talked there really well about the real pressures of the moment, the challenges of managing to find beds for all the people who need them, but also your real engagement in these wider things. But how do people, not just yourself as a chief executive, but how do other people in your organisation manage to balance that dealing with the here and now and also thinking into the longer term? It can't be easy. Have you any thoughts for our listeners on that?
What we're trying to do is encourage people to think about their working lives in thirds, especially senior people here who are opinion formers. And by senior people, I mean our consultants, our senior operational managers, our executives, our non-executives. There are many people in an organisation as complex as NUH who are leaders in their own rights. And by thirds, I mean, let's try and spend a third on the day-to-day, because running the hospital safely and well is very, very important, especially for our clinicians and our operational managers. Let's see if we can find, free up a third of our time for planning, think about the future. That's what People First tries to do. Let's see if we can predict the future as best we can and prepare for it. And then a third on what I call stakeholder management. In our case, that's being an active and a humble and inquisitive member of the integrated care arrangements, but also building relationships with other local institutions, our universities, our politicians, to make sure that they see NUH as a place that not only provides services well day in, day out, but is actively engaged in shaping the future. Now, that's easier said than done, especially if you're a busy consultant with a long list and feeling the after effects of COVID and trying to deal with the financial circumstances under which we all labour at the moment. But it's a state of mind. We all control our own diaries, and we are encouraging people as much as possible to engage not only in the day-to-day, but also in the future, and particularly invest in partnerships, because whatever you put in partnership, you get back manyfold.
That's brilliant. So I think the messages there are a lot of this about organising yourself and thinking deliberatively about how you're going to manage things, but also a lot about communications and engaging with other people, you know, right across the system. So that's really helpful. If I can move us on then to Melanie. Across the system, we're doing some big pieces of transformation work, which we hope will deliver on some of these longer term solutions for some of the key challenges. You know, some we've heard a little about already, but frailty urgent and emergency care, and also this shift into the community that we talk about a lot and I think is increasingly important. But I just wondered, from a local authority perspective, Mel, can you just say how you see the local authorities being involved in those work streams and those pieces of programmes?
Thank you, Cathy. I think I'll start with the fact we do have 9 local authorities that are actively involved in the transformation programme. That's in a whole range of ways. But I'll start with those that have statutory duties for children and adults, social care and public health. So the county council and the city council, key partners in the system transformation work, because of those statutory duties for social care and public health. You know, we have a key role in supporting that transformation work, alongside a wider role we have in promoting the wellbeing of our local communities through the whole range of things that we do as a county council. So we're involved in all of the work streams. So some of us are sponsors of the work. So I co-chair the transformation board. I have been the sponsor of the urgent care work. I've been the sponsor of some of the diagnostic work we've done in some of the urgent care transformation work streams, some of the detailed work. My colleagues, including principal social workers, managers, public health consultants, children's services leads, they're all involved in a number of different ways. So that might be co-leading work, might be co-sponsoring work, it might be being part of a steering group, it might be being part of a task and finish group, or it might just be being stakeholders that provide feedback and inputs, a whole range of ways. We've also got our place-based partnerships, and that really important part of the integrated care system, and that also includes our district and borough council colleagues in Nottinghamshire. So they're also part of that because they have important roles in housing and wellbeing in each of our 7 areas. So they've each got their own, their own roles within those place-based partnerships too, alongside us, who've got more of a delivery and commissioning responsibility. So we've got our own context, challenges and opportunities, and what we try to do is to reflect that in the transformation work, so try to reflect our own pressures, the needs of the population, the things that we want to see. So that's really what our goal is within that work, which kind of brings me along to another really important bit that local authorities have to play, which is articulating the needs of our population through our health and wellbeing boards in the integrated care strategy. So our health and wellbeing boards really understand the needs of the city and the county well, shape the integrated care strategy around that. And we try to make sure that what we're doing in the transformation work directly impacts on people's outcomes, because that's what we're here to do really, isn't it? Is to improve people's lives. I think we've got a bit of work to do to really make that feel that we're working on each other's agenda. So at the moment, we're really good, I think, at working on an integrated care system agenda. There's something about making sure that agenda is the widest possible. So there's a little bit of work to do, but that's really sophisticated, Cathy. So get into that stage where we can have a set of cost and benefit analysis that works to all of us, I think, is really sophisticated. But we're well onto that journey and we're trying to get there. So that's kind of what I think, to give you a few examples, what we're doing practically.
I think you've described what's happening across the system really, really well, and in terms of the different sort of geographical patches on which things are happening. I think you've described that extremely well. And I just wondered if I could move on to picking one of the transformation examples around frailty. And I just wondered if you could describe why you think this is so important and how it could make a difference to both, you know, social care, but also you know, the public's health services. It's an area that we often talk about, isn't it, frailty? It's an expanding area. And I know that we're doing some work on that. So any thoughts, Mel?
Yeah, that's a good example to choose, Cathy, because immediately for council colleagues, if you use the word frailty, it's not a term that we use. It's not really one that we would identify with or that we think fits with our values. So I think it's a really great example to show how we make those linkages about what's important to people. So within Nottinghamshire, we support around 7,000 older adults to live, and that might be in generally in care homes or their own home, it might be in prisons or institutions, a whole range of settings that people live there. And all of those older adults at some point will start to experience some greater impacts on their well-being, which is part of age. And what we do recognise through the frailty work is that there's a greater vulnerability to adverse outcomes such as falls or infection, disability, hospitalisation that occurs to older adults. And each time that happens, the older adult will need more care and support, whether that's from social care, whether that's from a health service, or indeed some of the other services that we mentioned, maybe housing support or some other community services. So what we do recognise in the council, although that word frailty might not naturally sort of fall within a strength-based framework, that drive to really think about how do we work better together to live older adults, to live greater quality of life, to live independently, to manage their health in a proactive way, I think is where we've got some common goal and shared agenda. So the frailty transformation work tries to improve the way that we do that together. And it's really good that Stephen sort of popped the podcast, because that bit about identifying and supporting people in their own home, it happens through primary and community services. We're getting it a bit wrong if it's happening through Anthony's hospital services, for example. So what we try to do is to think about how do we work together in an integrated way, whether that's through some of the multi-agency teams within primary care, whether that might be some of the enhanced and additional supports you put in place either around a care home or maybe around some of the hubs that we have operating or virtual wards. Really, the goal is to thinking about how do we enable people to have timely and responsive care that keeps them well for as long as possible in a place they call home and surrounded by people they love. So that's our kind of shared goal.
Thank you. I do think this point you highlight about the words that we use don't always mean the same to all parties. And that's really interesting, isn't it, about frailty? It's not in your lexicon of strength-based approach. So I think there's important to have understanding about that. And I think it takes us nicely on to the next to Lucy. You know, I mentioned that prevention is one of the key principles within our integrated care strategy. And I know, Lucy, we have in the past spent several hours on the definition of prevention. So that's another of these words that I think means different things to different people. But I just wondered if you could say a little, Lucy, about why it's so important to focus on prevention rather than deal with issues later down the line. I mean, it may seem really obvious, but I think there's some important things to say on this. Over to you.
Lovely, Cathy, and thank you. That definition of the word prevention is really interesting. And sometimes we actually are talking about demand prevention, the prevention of us doing stuff. For me in public health, it's really about that prevention of ill health. And it's got a really strong moral imperative. We should try and avoid people experiencing harm where we can. And when Melanie was talking, she was talking about frailty as being an undesirable endpoint, that what we should be doing is all of the actions about enabling people to live healthy lives so they can live independently as well as they can. And that's about prevention. If we think about smoking, it's definitely better if we never smoke. That's definitely the first thing. So there's activities that we can do to mean that people never smoke. And we're beginning to see, aren't we, through government policy, that attempt to build a smoke-free generation, to make smoking a never event for people, which is really exciting in my world. But actually, if people do smoke, giving up smoking at any point brings health benefits. And definitely, if you take it, sticking with that kind of frailty being an undesirable endpoint, similarly with smoking, living with COPD or living and dying of cancer are really undesirable endpoints and totally avoidable. 99% of COPD is linked directly to smoking, very small amount around naught, totally preventable, and yet really impacts on people's lives, their ability to live independently, their ability to hold down jobs, their ability to spend time with their grandchildren. And if we can therefore prevent stuff from either happening in the beginning or getting worse, then there's a real advantage for us, both in terms of the resilient, independent communities we'll form, but also, we have to be honest, about how we use money. Because if we're spending money on some of these things, it means that we're not able to spend money on some other things. And if we stick with smoking as an example, for every pound we spend in prevention, it saves us £14 further on in terms of some of that treating those undesirable outcomes. And we all have a role in prevention. So it's not my job to prevent stuff. It's part of my job. But if we think about that, stopping stuff before it starts or stopping stuff from getting worse, everybody around this call is really proactive in some of those conversations that they have, the ways that we build our patient pathways, for example, the conversations that we have with people. Primary care is a key example of really great opportunities when somebody comes with a bad knee to have a conversation with them around their diet, their exercise, their smoking habits, and some of that social connectivity as well, because mental health is a huge factor here in terms of keeping people well and healthy.
Thank you, Lucy. That's really helpful to hear. And I think you're figures there around the, you know, just from a monetary perspective, never mind about the health benefits, are very, very powerful. But you've personally worked across the NHS, local government. You've had a broad exposure, if you like, to all of these areas. And you must have had a chance to see some seriously impressive changes that have come about because teams have worked together and focused on their communities. Are you able to share any of those with us?
A really great question. So I'm very fortunate to be based in a local authority because it gives me access to wider teams that I didn't have when I was based in the NHS. And a really great example we'd have to draw from COVID around the getting the vaccines out. And we quite rightly did a build it and they will come approach. We built big vaccine centres, and for large amounts of our population, that drew them in. The real advantage of joint working around prevention is those challenging communities, the communities that either didn't feel they had the information to make the decision to vaccinate, or are underserved in terms of health and find it harder to come forward. And we were really able to help build some of those links with communities and use our communities to help us get some of those messages out and increase participation in vaccination. More outside of that COVID example, in Nottingham City, we have a brilliant Changing Futures programme, which is focused on people with severe multiple deprivation. And that brings together people from the criminal justice system, from the NHS, from local authorities, who all work collectively, but based around the needs of the individual. And it is around preventing those people from moving to a more crisis position. The earlier we can intervene and recognise the complexity of some of our population, the bigger the difference that we can make. And I think that's one of the most seriously impressive, because it's not just the work that we have commissioned people to do, it's the ideas that they generate by working together, by being co-located, by thinking differently, has meant that we've brought about more change than if I'd ever just asked one person to do one of those tasks.
That's brilliant. And I think there are potentially other examples as well, but that's a really, really good one. We'll come back to everybody at the end, but I want to move on now to Stephen. Primary care has already been mentioned, Stephen, of course, and we know that the services in primary care, a bit like everywhere else, but in particular, I think, are under a lot of pressure. And I know you're very interested in the strategic world. But why do you think it's important for general practice staff, community pharmacists, the other primary care staff, to make time for this this kind of work? I could just imagine you've got a list of 20 patients to see every morning. How can you lift your gaze and think about other things? What are your thoughts?
Well, there is, Cathy, a saying used to inspire people to take action and not to wait around for somebody else to step up first. And that's, if not us, who? And that's, you know, primary care, it's hackneyed to say, but it's nevertheless true that primary care is the linchpin of any health and care system. And the linchpin, of course, is that bit of the axle through which the pin is passed to stop the wheel falling off. So in a very real sense, that's a powerful metaphor. I think the steady personal commitment in primary care over time saves lives. The evidence is very strong about it saves lives. It improves health outcomes. It can improve the experience of care and reduces inequalities and moderate costs. The evidence base is strong and consistent in that direction and has been for a very long time. So there's no help, there's no functioning, high-performing health or care system anywhere that isn't grounded on the basis of good, ambitious, resilient, and positive primary care. Day by day, year by year, in Nottingham and Nottinghamshire, primary care clinicians provide multidimensional personal care and at the same time system support. They have a deep knowledge of their patients and their families, in the context of their patients and the families in their context in the place that they live and the jobs that they do and the relationships which they have. GPs and other primary care clinicians and care professionals also have a deep knowledge around quality improvement and service development, and they understand patient-centeredness. They are most physically proximal to the patient, but also often living amongst the patients, but also they're closest to the patients, so it's closest to the understanding of patient need. They know how to lead system changes in quality and safety and culture, and how to engage and influence and impact cultural change. And critically, I've seen over a long career now, I mentioned 32 years as a GP, they constantly bring new ways of thinking and innovative ideas for improving the quality of patient care to reduce harm and improve patient centeredness and patient outcomes. So I think there's a triple win up for grabs here, a win for patients, a win for the system and its citizens, and a win for our professionals as well in primary and community care.
That's great, Stephen. And I know you are very committed to this sort of, you know, inspiring people to take part. I think this concept, if not us, who? It takes me back to a famous occasion when David Nicholson, a previous CEO of the NHS, looked at a room of senior leaders and said, there isn't another room of people who can do this work. It is you. And I think that is a very good principle. So with all this positivity around all the things you've talked about, I just want to ask you all one question now. And how, if they're not already involved, how can you encourage staff who are working in your own organisations, your own bit of territory, to get involved? But if I can come first of all, Anthony, to you, how are you? You've got your Patient First programme, but how are you engaging and enthusing people to get involved?
Pretty much everyone I've met since I've worked here has demonstrated an enormous sense of vocation and commitment to wanting better population health, not just better services at NUH. And pretty much everybody here has got an opinion about how we should do that. And quite often they do it from an informed perspective, but sometimes not. So if you take, for example, the difference around language and terminology and expectation and context that Melanie outlined, you'll find that writ large in my organization. So when we have those conversations in the trust, more often now we have them in a very honest way, which is, first of all, have we got some kind of groupthink going on here where we think that what happens in NUH is the only and most important thing that happens in our system? Mostly the answer to that is no. I'm not sure that's always been the case in big hospitals, but these days people genuinely feel working in an integrated way is the right thing. That leads us to the second question. Do you see the senior people around you modelling good partnership behaviour? And we encourage our senior colleagues to do that, and more people in the trust recognise that we're making an extra effort to be a good partner. And then the final question is, so what have you got to lose? Because at the moment, things are busy. We're all strapped for cash. Everyone's struggling with the effects of COVID and the COVID recovery and living and working in a more complex and diverse society than we've ever worked and lived in. So what have we got to lose by working with our partners and trying to plan for the future. What Lucy said about working in a local authorities, it resonates with me because each organisation has its own take on integration and what it brings and the potential for doing more of it. And yet there are few opportunities for us to get together as you've brought us together here and thrash out the first principles. And when you get to first principles, you soon realise that most of us are in this for the same reasons. It's a strong sense of vocation, wanting things to be better, leaving our organisations better than we found them. And that final question, and what have you got to lose, is such an important question because we are in control of our diaries. We can carve out time for this stuff if we want to. And if we all want to, and most people say they do, what's stopping us then?
Now, I think that's absolutely brilliant. And I think what you are pointing out there, that even if everybody's incredibly busy, the importance of engaging together, understanding the meaning of things and having that shared intent, it's well worth it because it will pay back anyway. And you'll probably find your diary is freer later on. So I think those are really helpful things. Mel, any thoughts from yourself is how you're going to ensure that people are, how are you convincing people that this is a good thing to engage with?
So people in adult social care and in fact health and care, they do it because they're really passionate about making a difference to people's lives. We don't do it, do we, to get wealthy or to have status. We do it because we're really caring about the people that we're supporting and with a great deal of passion. And as Anthony said, often our colleagues have really clear views about how we can do that. And often we'll see that other people or other services or maybe the deprivation or the life circumstances that people are finding get in the way. And in terms of solving that, we can't do that alone. The only way we can solve those problems and start to overcome the barriers that people face in enjoying a good life and being, you know, full of health and well-being is by working together and stepping outside of our comfort zone and trying to solve it. Because individually, none of us can do that alone, whether that's individually as a person or individually as an organisation.
Great. That's really good. There's a slightly different take on it, but obviously, as you say, there's some commonality here. So, Lucy, what are your thoughts on this?
So I agree with everything that's been said before. So in order to say something different, I'm going to put a bit of a provocation, which is I think we have to be brave. And I think there's two main ways that we have to be brave. And I think Anthony articulated the fact that and Mel, that as leaders, we're willing to be brave in this way. In our current context, we're going to have to stop doing some stuff. We can't afford to do everything. We're going to have to be brave enough to still invest in the prevention stuff, because quite often we are taken in order to deliver against certain targets, which mean that we invest in that stuff, which is for people who are in greatest need. It's about ED, it's about waiting lists. We've got to be brave and keep our focus on making the change earlier. And it does take us to be brave because we are going to have to use money in a different way. And I also think we have to be brave about recognising that we'll share some of the benefits of that, and that I might invest some money that might deliver some savings across the NHS or in social care. And that I've got to be OK with that. And I think that's where that partnership work that Anthony was talking about is so important, because if we can come together and think differently about if you used to spend 10, but now you can only spend 5, and I'm in the same position. Actually, how do we more cleverly spend our 10 together and realise the benefits? And that's the real opportunity of working together in a different way.
That's great. And that's an inspiring message, isn't it? Because actually it does make it better for people. But there is something for me about, you know, helping people think about the population and not their organisation, you know, touching on what you were saying there, Lucy. So I think that the message is, in a way, if we summarise it, is help people to see that the path forward and then support and enable them to get on with it because they do know what to do. It's just helping them motivate to see that there is a better world, and there's a better world for our population. We can make progress. We are making progress. But I think it's been fascinating listening to everybody. sharing from your different perspectives, how you're seeing the progress of the, you know, the sort of implementation really of the strategy that we worked so hard to create. And I just want to thank you for your input. And we'll finish there.